again. Exceptional, that's all I heard. She's not like anyone else. You wonder why she captured you like a firefly and makes you shine like you never could alone. Hey everybody, welcome to Drive Through HR. Brian, William, and Nisha coming to you live every single day talking about HR with people that love HR. So we are going to have to make a technical exception today because, you know, we don't tend to spend a lot of time talking about any California schools when it comes to sports, but we might have to make the exception today. One time only, because they sucked worse than my Big Ten school. So we'll have to make the exception. William, how are you today?
I am fantastic, Brian. Just got a phone with CEO at Smarterer. It's a skills testing play out of Boston. Just really enjoyed the call, really enjoyed kind of what they're doing and how they're coming to market. So it's been a good morning.
Very, very bright woman leading that leading the charge over there. Really like her.
Agreed.
So, well, you know what? I think for a couple minutes, we just need to clear the air here. We had some tension before in the call. There were people who were offended. There was some slight hating going on, a lot of judging. So, but let's get to our guest first. So, Russ Klaus, welcome to Drive Through HR.
Well, thank you. And I was doing none of the hating or the besmirching.
Nor were I. So I'm not going to say who. I'm not going to lead us down that path. But so what's, you know, you guys excited? You got a new basketball coach, right, that took the money and run? Is that what I heard?
Heading out to USC?
We're optimistic about the basketball coach out at USC, but he's never won anything. So, you know, expectations are high at a school that this is the sole sport that they play that they've never won a championship in, is men's basketball. And they recruit on the same playgrounds as UCLA. Huh? And, well, I lean toward my wife's Big Ten alma mater on the basketball front. I will say UCLA remains the gold standard for men's college basketball. No one's going to ever equal what they accomplished.
How do you think Steve Alford's going to do there in the shadow of Dr. Wooden?
It's a big shadow.
Yeah.
It's a big shadow.
Yeah.
And UCLA, you know, has all the magic that was Pauley Pavilion seems to have disappeared from the building when they tore it down and rebuilt it.
Yeah.
There was it's a pro analogy, not a college analogy, but there was RG3 put out on his website yesterday a meme about you know, you've reached a certain point when the Michigan Wolverines have won more playoff games in Texas Stadium than the Dallas Cowboys have. There's some of that going on at UCLA.
It's true.
That's just fun. If it's true, you can say it. And even if it's not, you can still say it. That's what makes it fun. So, okay, I've got over being so offended at the narrative in the pre-show. I've worked my way through it. So,
well, you know, here's the thing, Brian. We all like programs that traditionally have had great – I mean, if you look back the history of college football, Nebraska, USC, and Alabama are all great programs. And it's an ebb and flow. You have good years. You have bad years. I mean, you know, people like to point at the recent history of Alabama. But, man, when I went there, 91 to 94, we had a national championship and then nothing. For like 15 years, we could barely scratch out enough SEC wins to make a bowl. So, I mean, it is
an ebb and flow. My experience at USC was much the same, 87 to 91. Three Rose Bowls. We came in second to Notre Dame in 90. We won nothing, and it had been, I don't know, since 1981, 1980, somewhere in there, until, you know, Pete Carroll got there was anything won at Troy, but... You take Notre Dame, Michigan, Alabama, and USC, and you've accounted for one-third of the college football championships that have ever been awarded.
Wow.
You throw Nebraska, Oklahoma on top of that. Cal's got five. Now you've accounted for about half of them, right?
You know, I really wanted, when A&M went to the SEC, I really, because it was such a hoo-ha-ha around Texas and their network and all that stuff, I really wanted Oklahoma to come with them so that the SEC would have Oklahoma and A&M, but it didn't work out that way. We got Missouri and like, eh.
See, I leaned the other way, and before the University of Texas got greedy about the television money, the
yeah.
deal that would have brought Oklahoma, Oklahoma State, Texas, and Texas A&M into the Pac-12,
that
would have
cool.
created a conference that would have destroyed the SEC in just about any sport.
Yeah, it would have been, yeah, because all four of those schools all have pretty good reputations in something. So, yeah, you're right. That would have been an epic deal.
Well, you would have Texas, California recruiting. I mean, that's pretty, you're starting to pull from like two-thirds of the talent pool in
pretty
the
much.
Country there.
Yeah.
So, but, hey, enough of this boring stuff. Talking about college football, let's get to the stuff that's sexy. Russ, if you would, introduce yourself to our millions of listeners, and then we'll get into what's going on in your world.
So the really short version is I am currently the workforce planning leader for the Americas at Hewlett-Packard. I am responsible for our services business from Canada to Argentina. And it's workforce planning, and so it's a strategic role, and I'm looking more at not that we don't do reporting, but more what does the workforce need to look like 3 years, 5 years down the road, and how does the business evolve? I've been in HR for 22 years, about half of it inside, about half of it on the management consulting side at PwC and IBM. By whatever fluke, I seem to have navigated toward high-tech companies, you know, between PwC, IBM, now HP, and I spent 6 years at Microsoft as well. So that's the majority of my career. We're poking fun of my undergraduate alma mater out in L.A. I also have a master's degree from NYU, so I got one from either side. If I ever get a doctorate, I guess I got to go live in the middle somewhere. Most of my focus the last, call it, decade or so has been from a process and strategy perspective in the talent management space and in the workforce planning space, and not so much in the transactional hands-on space of the profession, where there's obviously massive transformation going on in the outsourcing and other activities. I've come to view technology, since we all talk about that all the time, as an enablement mechanism and certainly a valuable one, but not the end-all be-all, because some of the things that I've spent the last few years of my life on, there are no technology solutions for that are magic silver bullets to solve, and
no.
So we're all still doing it in glorified Excel spreadsheets. Some rather sophisticated ones.
Yeah. Pivot tables on top of pivot tables. Let's get into what's top of mind for you these days. And I want to say keeping you up at night, but really it's what's occupying a lot of your brains these days, Russell.
So what's occupying my brain is there's obviously some major shifts going on in the high-tech industry. You've seen companies like IBM transform themselves from product companies to service companies, and I rode that wave while I was there. HP is doing it. Xerox is doing it. A lot of change at Dell, but they started down that road before the privatization talks began as well with their acquisition of Pro Systems. So there's this major shift in the industry, and when you talk about services, whether it's high-tech services, financial services, real estate, anything where it's a person doing the work as opposed to I'm making a widget, you're selling people. And so it becomes both an HR dream and an HR nightmare, because the sophistication of your competency models directly relates to the sophistication of both your product offering and your pricing schemes. So what's keeping me up at night is HP is, and I hate to throw massive buzzwords, but we are moving in a big way into the concepts of big data and cloud computing and how we deliver those services for our customers in traditional IT outsource environments has direct impacts on the workforce. You can't do something better, faster, cheaper than your customer can if you're just going to hire the same people they were employing in New York City. And so we start to look at, should this work be done in Costa Rica? Should it be done in Budapest? What pieces of it should be done where? And not so much for today in the immediate, but for next year, the year after, as it continues to evolve. and what's the right mix of workforce contingent to permanent? What is the right mix of the workforce from a experiential level? Do I need 30 college graduates supporting this account, or do I need 30 guys that have been at this for 20 years? And it's not about age. It's more about balance of cost and experience, because you don't need a deep, deep subject matter expert to do everything. Most of the time, good enough is good enough.
Right. What's your take? There's a lot of blogs and a lot of articles and books that are written on the skills gap. You're looking at, you know, the vast ocean of skills gap. What's your particular take on our preparedness for either the boomers all retiring or the kids coming out of college? Like, what's your take on the skills gap?
So I don't think of it quite the same way. I'll give you two different spins there. I have a take on the baby boomers leaving the that points to the obvious need for knowledge management and for intellectual capital capture and transfer. But at the same time, and I hate to overgeneralize like this, the baby boomers are at a point in their careers where they're at maximum earnings, right? They're earning, in most cases, the most that they will earn in their lifetimes. But they've also passed that peak, the Hubert peak, if you will, of their productivity, and are on the downside of that slope. That's not a negative thing. It happens to everyone. But part of the economic drag, especially in the services industry, and this trend toward globalization and emerging markets with younger workforces, is hampered by they aren't retiring in the numbers we were all expecting. That doesn't mean we would like 80% of baby boomers to retire tomorrow, but a slow, steady march instead of cliffs would be better. Now, that's driven by global economic conditions more than it is anything else, but it's also a generation that all the research says has defined themselves by their jobs. Now, in my industry, and for our skill sets, it's also a generation that did not grow up with computers and came to them later, and so they are not as intuitively a part of their self as they are for the kids that are getting out of college today. And in the middle, of course, you have Generation X. That's kind of a little bit both. The kids that are coming out today, whether we use Generation Y or Millennials, and this seems to be global, it's not just a U.S. phenomenon, they come out of school with technical skills and global experiences and, to some extent, leadership skills and this ability to see the big picture that most of us had to earn the hard way. And so that skill set is wonderful, but that doesn't make up for experience. And it's not that someone isn't qualified to do a job on paper. Actually, running a program is different than what it looks like in a classroom. The nature of academia is such that it's always going to trail the leading edge. And especially in the services economy, the leading edge is where you differentiate yourself from your competitors. And the only way to get that is to go out and do. And so that doesn't mean you need 15 years of experience, but 3, 4, 5, and see things go wrong and how people react to that, as well as just what happens when things go the way that they're supposed to, is important. And so I think there's a little bit of both of that going on. The generation coming up is as big as the baby boom, but it's not located in the same places.
Nice.
Right? So
well,
I can tell you.
Yeah, go ahead.
So for example, in Brazil, HP has total HP, not just services, but HP has a workforce of close to 26,000 people. That's as many as we employ in California, but we don't think of them the same way. If I look at them demographically, the workforce in Brazil is probably 80% under the age of 40. If I look at the workforce in California, it's a pretty even spread to what society looks like.
Interesting. Let me ask you to pivot over to visas, and I want to get your thoughts on workplace visas.
So I have mixed thoughts on it. I saw the same article that all of you saw yesterday that said,
right,
you know, there's this mad scramble going on, and we're about to hit our H-1 cap, and I'm old enough to remember the 90s before the dot-com burst, and, you know, when we used to hit those caps in December, and they were arguing with lawmakers about raising them. There is something to be said for, we live in a world of global talent, and I'm a citizen of one country, I work for a company based in another, and I actually work in a third, is the way that we're moving, and so we want to allow for a highly skilled workforce that movement across borders. And especially in certain industries, and high tech is one of them, there is an absolute shortage in certain countries of labor, and the United States is one of those countries. We do not produce computer science majors, math majors, engineering majors, statisticians in the same numbers that other countries do. It is less than 5% of our college graduation rates, and within that, you know, it's only a population of 300 million and a workforce of 120 million to begin with, and so you start getting down and demand is far exceeding supply, which creates competition and drives the cost up of everything. H1s are one way of offsetting that. At the same time, I've also been around long enough to see all the cheating that occurs. And by cheating, I'm not saying the sweatshops that are hiring some kid from India and paying them one-third what they would an American. I'm saying that the law actually says you have to not only justify the need, but that you can't find an American to do it and then pay competitive wage. And that's a little harder to prove, but I guarantee it's occurring at any number of companies without besmirching anybody, that someone gets hired and there is no internal look at talent to say, should we have hired that person or did we have someone else that wasn't fully utilized or could have done the job? Or did we actually make the effort to source in Texas and hire off of the Texas A&M campus versus, you know, University of Mumbai. And I'm not besmirching Indians either. They have a larger diaspora than anybody else on the planet for the kinds of skills I look at. China's not far behind them. But one has to ask why all that movement at the same time as companies like HP, IBM, Accenture, take your pick. We're all opening up research labs still in India and in China, because it's easier to grab the talent locally. And if I bring someone over from China, and I say this having been an expat there myself, if I can get an H-1 and I bring over this highly skilled engineer from China and pay him $70,000 a year to live in the Silicon Valley, is that better or worse than if I pay him $10,000 a year to live in Shenzhen, China, where that $10,000 has the same buying power of $150,000 in the Silicon Valley? Is it better for him? Is it better for me? Where are my spans of control? They're not simple issues. And so to the HR practitioner today and to people like myself in workforce planning specifically, these are the kinds of questions we have to ask, and then we have to try and put numbers to it as well. We went through a wave of people saying, I'm going to move my call centers to India because it's cheaper. Or I'm going to do my software development in China because it's cheaper. And dollar for dollar salary equivalent in U.S. dollars, yeah, absolutely, until you start factoring in experience, management costs, time zones, you know, spans of control, regulatory environments. So we've all seen contraction in the market in the last 3-4 years as the economy has slowed down and in many countries gone into recession. How many companies are just at the point where they're just adjusting their European workforces now because it takes 4 years before you can even get through the workers' councils to do workforce reductions if that becomes necessary? And how is that going to impact hiring decisions going forward? And I don't know the answer to any of these questions, but when we do scenario planning, these are the questions we're asking. And we're asking against our business models, and we're asking what our competitors are doing as comparison points. Right, so if Accenture is ramping up in Buenos Aires, that doesn't mean HP is going to, but we're certainly going to ask, what do they see that we don't see?
Hey, Russell, let me do a quick reset. Everybody listening to Drive Through HR, we're on with Russ Foss from HP. I know one of the things that comes up in conversation is you're in a marketplace that one huge company, global reach. How do you find some of the when you start talking about security experts, I mean, especially with the cloud and you've got some big changes going on with mobile, where do you go find security experts that just don't exist for your business, as an example?
So I'm not in staffing is the first thing I'm going to say, and it's not a small
sure.
challenge. And I'll put a little plug in and say we have over 400 recs open right now for InfoSec types globally, quite a few of them in the United States. We're struggling with that just like others are. But it becomes a question of there's a certain number in the marketplace, and you can buy that talent. You can also rent that talent from a pick your vendors, whether it's on an SOW basis or it's as an actual contractor. And we do both of those things because we have price models we have to adhere to. In the longer-term strategy, as a big company with global reach, we're in a position to influence curricula in countries where we see that these things would be beneficial. And so we are doing a lot of that outreach, whether it's through funding chairs in computer science universities in South Africa, or whether it's just getting involved in FISI and other industry groups that encourage those kind of education. And you raised InfoSec. The biggest consumer of InfoSec services is the U.S. federal government, and they have DOD and DHS directives that say people have to be certified and have a certain level of training to have the super user accesses that is essential for those jobs. And so we have a partner and a customer both that is pushing the same levers we are pushing in the same places we are pushing them. And so we actively seek to cultivate that partnership. That said, we're doing what everyone else is doing. We're training some of them ourselves. We're paying headhunters to find them for us. This is a necessary evil for a highly in-demand skill set that is an absolute market differentiator.
Nice.
Let me follow that with one last thought. We talk about critical positions in HR, in succession planning, and one of the mistakes we've all seen is hierarchical succession planning and just assuming that because someone has a C next to the name that that's the most critical position. In high tech today, InfoSec is a critical position. They are as critical to our success and to that of our competitors as our COO is or our CFO is. On a day-to-day basis, I can make a pretty good argument they're more essential.
Nice. Actually, that's what's going to be the next question was, in an optimal world, how should we do and how should we approach succession planning?
So I'm a fan of there is no one right answer, but there are plenty of wrong answers. I believe in what the U.S. government likes to call its blue book, which is a pipeline approach that says for our top 300 most critical positions, let's have some named successors in the pipeline, and let's make sure that John Smith's name isn't on the successor list for five people because he can only fill one of those positions. But I have to have a plan in place that says if John Smith gets hit by a bus today walking across the street and it's going to cost me money every day his job is open, how am I going to fill it? In the bigger picture, from a developmental point of view, succession planning can't just be about creating pipelines. It's got to be about creating pools of competencies. And this goes back to my earlier comment about competency models. And however you define it, three or four sets of competencies, core, technical, leadership, position-specific, there's different ways to look at it. But time spent there in defining those and cataloging those within your workforce empowers all of your talent management activities as well as your ability to do strategic workforce planning and other things, and gives you the how ready are people and are we building the pipelines we need. I'm of the belief 60 to 70% of your succession plan should come from within, and another 20 to 30 somewhere in there should plan on going outside because you always want to have some ability to mix things up and to change things. And I'm also of the belief that you don't actually succession plan for your top three positions. They're board appointments anyway. You can inform the board, but don't spend HR time and money and effort dwelling on who the next CEO is going to be because the board's going to decide, not HR. Spend your time and effort on money on focusing on who the next head of your services division is going to be or who the next head of your printers division is going to be, because that is an HR decision. The CEO will take HR's advice to the table when they say, these are the three people he's mentoring to do this, and this is where this one is, and this is where that one is. And we think we have four or five others in our potential pool coming up. And then the final thought I'll throw on succession planning is it's not all about performance in today's job. There is too heavy an emphasis on performance management as the key criteria for what makes someone a high potential and therefore puts them in line for succession pools. That's part of the equation, to be certain, but potential is astronomically more important than day-to-day performance. And the example I'll give you is, in a Big Six environment, or Big Four environment, the associate partner role is the person that is responsible for managing multiple accounts and assuring delivery excellence. That role is not dissimilar from a managing partner role, which is a customer service role, and let's grow the accounts, but let's make sure everything's going smoothly with what we're doing for people as well. The role in between those, that partner role, is a business development role. These are the people that go out and beat the bushes and get new business for the company. They're not so worried about organic growth as they are new growth. So it stands to reason that a top performer at the associate partner role would also be a top performer at the managing partner role, but might be just an average performer at the partner role because it's a different job. Now, do they need the experience in the middle to be good at the latter? Absolutely. But you have to weigh all of those factors.
Nice. Hey, Russell, we got about 4 minutes left, and a question from the Twitter stream, and I think it's a really great one, is about hiring consultants internal. So the world of consultants we all know and love, what's the pluses and minuses of bringing a gal or a guy that's been a consultant for years internal in either a key role or a leadership role?
So fitting the bill myself, I'm obviously a fan of it. But I would say the biggest plus is consultants go out there and they see how it's been done. So in my toolkit, if you will, is this range of experiences of I've seen succession planning done incredibly well and I've seen it done so poorly it's shocking at some of the world's largest companies. And I have a global perspective and an experience building process, tools, strategies, enablement mechanisms. So if that's what you're looking for, consultants are fantastic to convert into internal hires. The downside of that is, while it is exactly the same competency, the actual doing, the day-to-day running, is different from the building. And so the questions that have to be probed in the interview are, where are their actual passions? Do they enjoy the challenge of building new solutions, or the challenge of tweaking existing ones and finding the holes in them and making them better? And are they going to get jaded if they are asked to do tactical transactional work when the world of a consultant is usually at the strategic level? Because the world of work internally, especially in back office operations, is primarily one of tactical and transactional, 7 days out of 10. So there's a little bit of both of that going on. Consultants tend to be slightly higher educated and cost a little more. They get paid as consultants for the things they're willing to do as consultants, travel 5 days a week, all these other things. And so at times
right.
That means decisions to take pay cuts for them. And at times, even if I don't force them to do that, I have to juggle my internal equity equation as well.
Sure. Russ, we got about time for one more quick question, and what's the last good read you had? Maybe where you're drawing some inspiration from.
So you're going to make me walk around because it's still sitting on my nightstand, so if you'll give me a second. I have been working my way through a strategy book that I picked up at a strategy and workforce planning conference in Atlanta at the beginning of March.
Mm-hmm.
I'm about two-thirds of the way through it. I just want to make sure I give you the right title, if you bear with me for a second. It's called Leapfrogging by Soren Kaplan. And the concept of the book is that surprises aren't a bad thing. Especially in big companies, there's this tendency to manage out the risk, and everything's about risk management, and I'm never going to cause my boss a surprise or heartburn. That's not how you innovate, though. You innovate by driving to risk, mitigated risk, but to risk, and learning from your mistakes.
Nice.
Well, that is a perfect way to wrap up. Where can we got about 15 seconds left. Where can people connect with you and thank you?
So I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter at RussMK. You can find me on Facebook. I'm a fairly easy guy to find. I have a unique last name. So if you don't find me directly, you're going to find someone I'm related to.
Well, that is fantastic. Great conversation today. Folks, we are going to roll on out. Have a good rest of the day. And be safe and do some innovative things today.